Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 20th, the year 2002. And Joe Arnett is doing a session, Plant Life of the North Cascades. This is session 5, Plants and Similar Organisms, a Symbiotic View. This is tape number ARJ 2002-11. So now let's go to the fireside room and join Joe in discussions of plants.
Tape recorder up there. I know most of you, but my name is Joe Arnett, and I've been serving the botanists for the last 2 weeks. I've been serving the village for the last 2 weeks as botanist. And so my job has been to teach people about plants as much as I can at whatever level of understanding they're at. Through the week, we've looked at different plant groups, like conifers, which are the main, the dominant plant in this area. And we looked at flowering plants, which are the most diverse plants by far. And then we've looked at communities and change within those communities. And this is the last section. And what our topic today is symbiosis, which is talking about how things work together. And it's a little bit of a biology class, so if you had a bad experience with biology, I apologize. I used to have a little microscope light that I got from my biology department. Somebody, some student in the past had scratched on it, "I hate biology." And I was really sorry about that because biology really is the study of life. And so I was sorry that that person had a bad experience. But with that introduction, I'm going to give a little bit of a biology class because it's the best approach to looking at how different kinds of organisms all interact on these very deep and fundamental levels. And I think it's one of the aspects of nature that's important and interesting. The theme of Holden this summer is 40 years in the wilderness, and to me wilderness is sort of looking at how nature works, how biology works without the involvement of humans. So the topic is symbiosis. And symbiosis in the broadest sense, well, symbiosis in the technical sense means organisms that live together, very intimate, close physical contact. But in the broader sense, symbiosis also means how all the different kinds of organisms interact on a big scale. For example, we all breathe oxygen, and all the oxygen we breathe has been produced by either green plants or green bacteria or algae that produce oxygen using the energy of sunlight, or release oxygen from water using the energy of sunlight. So that's symbiosis in the biggest sense. But we're going to talk about symbiosis in a specific sense. And for an introduction, I wanted to show you just a little outline of the types of organisms, just to say something about how different these things are. Some of them are plants, and some of them aren't. This is a modern classification of living things, and when I went to first went to college, we divided everything into plants and animals. And when you went to school, you might remember that. But as we've learned more about how things are built, the structures of cells and life cycles, we found that things don't really sort out very cleanly into two things, plants and animals. There's lots of other things. And so modern classification divides things into at least 5 kingdoms. And in some cases, they're dividing the bacteria even into separate kingdoms. So just to show you, the biggest division of living things is between bacteria and what are called, you could call more complex cells, or you could say the formal term is eukaryotes, which just means new cells. But these are fundamentally different. And just to give us a simple example, if we thought of all of these types of things as having cells about the size of this screen, that the bacterial cells would probably be about the size of my hand. So they're not just a little bit different, they're fundamentally different. And certainly in size, and also in complexity. The bigger cells, like all everything but bacteria, have a specialized nucleus, which is itself bigger than bacteria, and have other little organelles within the cell, which are sort of like bacteria. So that's just to point out these are fundamentally different, because when we look at some of the types of symbiosis, we'll see that there's lots of examples of bacteria interacting with plants or with fungi or protists. So there's a lot of interrelation. Within the higher organisms, to use that term for these bigger cells, we've divided it basically into four kingdoms. The fourth kingdom is animals, which isn't on here, which is pretty much self-explanatory if you think it's an animal. It is, pardon?
Animals?
Animals, yeah. I didn't put animals on here because these are plant-like organisms. But kingdom fungi, the fungi are really different in their structure and life cycle than plants. So traditionally, these were included in the study of plants or the study of botany, but they've been separated into a separate kingdom. And we'll look at some examples of where fungi interact in a symbiotic way with plants. And then there's another kingdom, which is protista, which is kind of a garbage can term, just for lack of a better word, that includes lots of things that are very different. Like if you've ever heard of Euglena, it's a little single-celled organism, and it acts like an animal because it swims around. It's motile. But it acts like a plant because it has photosynthesis. It's green. It's able to convert sunlight, take the energy in sunlight to convert water and carbon dioxide into oxygen and sugar. So they don't really fit into any of the other kingdoms. So this protista, I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere in the future that got divided up into several kingdoms, because there's so many different kinds of things in there. Even the large seaweeds, the algae, which are, many algae are single cell, but some algae are large seaweeds, aren't considered to be plants because their life cycle and structure are so different.
I don't remember that one when I took the biology in 1930.
You don't remember protists? You just had plants and animals, probably. And I don't know, that's what I had when I went to school, and I started in 68, started college in 68. I don't know which kingdom they put Euglena in, for example. They put it in plants or animals. And there's another one, Paramecium, Euglena is the one that's motile and photosynthetic. There's another one that has a single flagella that swims around. It's also photosynthetic. So I don't know in the old days if they put those in plants or animals. So anyway, we get down to plants, and there's a bunch of phyla, which are just big groups. And as I said, we talked earlier about conifers. If you're interested, before we go, I have some handouts, which are lists of all the conifers in the valley, which you can have. And we talked about flowering plants. Now we're going to talk mostly about interactions. There's some interactions between flowering plants and conifers, between flowering plants and fungi, between conifers and fungi, and with bacteria also interacting with plants, flowering plants and conifers. So I'm going to show you some examples of those. And I'll make this outline on the board, and then we can look at some actual photos, which may be more interesting than biology principles. To me, this topic of symbiosis is one of the interesting things about nature, because we tend to think of things as being separate. And these are examples of how things interact very closely. The first one I want to talk about is lichens. Is there anybody that knows what a lichen is? Do you know?
I wouldn't be able to describe it, but it grows on trees.
Some of them grow on trees, some of them...
Pardon? Rocks.
Some of them grow on rocks. Well, here's one that was growing on a tree, and here's some that are growing on a rock. But lichens, I'll pass these around just so you can look at them to get a closer example. Heck,
it seems to me like a parasite.
Well, they're not considered parasitic.
No.
They don't use the rock to grow.
And actually, on that line, I'll tell you another thing. In symbiosis, there's three main types. And one is a mutually beneficial relationship. What I'm describing here with the lichens is a mutual. Mutually beneficial. And this lichen, there's two that are going around. This one that's bright yellow is called wolf lichen. And it grows up. It's very common through the woods here. If you walk, you'll see it hanging on the bark of ponderosa pine and Douglas fir. It's bright yellow. It's a really colorful one. What a lichen is it's a symbiosis between a fungus, which forms the body of the lichen. And the way the fungus grows is it grows in a mycelium, which is a long thread-like, like a string of cells. And I'll just draw it diagrammatically like this. And in this lichen, both of these kinds, this one, this wolf lichen, the tissue of the lichen is made up of these threads that are packed tightly together. It's kind of like the mushrooms that grow in the forest. You know, the mushroom that actually comes out of the ground. Well, there's a mycelium, or this thread-like growth, that is all through the soil, and in some cases all through rotting wood, decaying wood. And then when it pushes out this mushroom that you can see, the mycelium forms a very compact structure, but still made of these thread-like structures. In the lichen, that thread-like structure provides the body of the lichen, and then there's single cells within the body, which are photosynthetic. And I'll draw it diagrammatically like this. And sometimes these are in layers, the tissue is in layers, which might be in leaf-like layers like this. We call it a foliose lichen. Or they might be in cylinders. This one is called a fruticose lichen. It's the layers of tissue are in columns or cylinders. Or sometimes it's just like this. These are crustose lichens, which grow right attached to the rock. So we think of this relationship between the fungus and the photosynthetic part, which might be a bacteria. Or an algae. So it's a two-parted symbiosis, or sometimes three. Some lichens, I don't know that these are, that this wolf lichen does, but some of the leafy lichens that grow in the old forest on the west side, they actually have both, or all three. They have a fungus and an algae, and he has a great voice, he or she. Yes, you have a very sweet voice. Yeah. Either bacteria, in all cases a fungus, and then a bacteria and or an algae. And the bacteria or the algae do the photosynthesis, produce the sugars, which are used by the fungus, and the fungus provides an environment for the algae or bacteria. So we call that a mutually beneficial relationship, or mutualism, to call it an ism. Now, in some cases, we have what's called a commensalism.
And does the fungus provide the water?
Pardon?
Does the fungus provide the water? Or just the structure?
In lichens, lichens don't have any conductive tissue, so the moisture comes out of the atmosphere, rain or condensation. And so they retain the moisture. You know, on a very small scale, they have create an environment that's more moist inside than outside.
Yeah.
So in that regard, they do. Yeah. So commensalism is a situation where one species benefits and the other
has a neutral effect. So this lichen here growing on a tree, as far as we know, is not parasitic. It has no effect on the tree. And so it's a neutral relationship as far as the tree goes, but it's beneficial between the components of the lichen. These are just some little examples, but in some cases the lichens are a very major part of the ecosystem. And one reason they're so important is because if there are bacteria, they're able to fix nitrogen. We use the term fix nitrogen. And one of the limiting nutrients in most natural systems is nitrogen. If we think of our own bodies, all of our proteins have atoms of nitrogen in every amino acid in every protein. You know, proteins are made of amino acids, and the word amino is a chemical group that has nitrogen in it. All of that nitrogen has to come from atmospheric nitrogen through a fixation process, which used to be either lightning, which causes a little bit of this nitrogen fixation, or from bacteria. And these bacteria may occur in lichens, or they may occur in other settings, which I'll describe in a second. But the important thing to think about is that we live in this atmosphere of nitrogen, but it's bound in this N2 form, and it's very hard to break that apart to get it into a form that we can use. We can't use N2, you know, the nitrogen in its atmospheric form. And it takes a great deal of power or energy to break apart that nitrogen so it can be used. And in the present day, I was told, I don't know if this number is accurate, that 30% of the nitrogen in our bodies now comes from chemical fertilizer factories, where they provide the energy for breaking that nitrogen apart and making nitrate fertilizer. But historically, it all came from, almost all of it from bacteria, and a very small amount from lightning. The energy of lightning is enough to break some of that nitrogen apart. So I don't know if I explained that very well, but the point is that these bacteria, as being the only organisms that can break apart the nitrogen, are extremely important to the whole system, even though we can't see them. And the next type of symbiosis I want to talk about also is involved with bacteria that fix nitrogen, and it's nitrogen fixing bacteria in a broader sense. Nitrogen-fixing bacteria. And the one that most people are most familiar with is in the roots of legumes, like beans and peas and lupins. They have a type of bacteria called rhizobium. And these bacteria are able to do this nitrogen fixation. Put it into the soil. You know, we plant a cover crop of clover, plow it in. The reason for that is that the clover has a relationship with this bacteria in the roots that fix nitrogen. And so it's like using a biological process to put nitrogen fertilizer into the soil. And there's another one here. There's a common one in the mountains here. We don't have many legumes, or we do have some, but there's another one that has a relationship with alders. And it's a similar type of bacteria. It's called actinomycete. These are just different types of bacteria. And I actually have a specimen to show you. I'm going to take these leaves off to keep them out of the room. But these are just alder seedlings that are growing along the road. And I'll pass these around if the light is good enough to see them in here. But there are nodules on the roots, growing on the roots. Are you able to see them? They're not like real flashy, but they're growing in there. And what's going on is this: the nitrogen, the bacteria actually, you could think of it as infection of the roots, but it's certainly a penetration of the roots. And the plant is grows to form these nodules, which form an environment for the bacteria to grow. And this is, in the Northwest here, this is a major source of nitrogen being put into the soil. That these actinomycete bacteria fix nitrogen. And this enables these alders to grow in very poor soil. You know, you see it growing right in the gravel along the road. Well, one of the reasons that they're able to do that is because they have this source of nitrogen as a fertilizer. So you're welcome to join us, come up here.
No, I'm okay.
You're happy back there? Okay.
Thank you.
So that's our second type of symbiosis. And it's also a form of mutualism, where it appears to be beneficial both to the alder or to the clover and to the bacteria that grows in the roots. There are probably, and I don't know the ecological importance, but there are also bacteria that just grow free in the soil, which are also actinomycetes, and that are also able to carry out this conversion of nitrogen. The third main kind of symbiosis is very similar in a way, because it's a type of organism we don't see and grows in the soil, but has a very important beneficial effect on the plants that they're associated with. And these are called mycorrhizal fungi. And we can't see these for the most part. They're not totally microscopic. In some cases where they form a contact with the roots, you can actually see them. But if you remember, a fungus grows in this long thread-like mycelium. I keep using that word, I'll write it up here. This is your I don't know if you ever see that in the crossword puzzle or not, but so one of our biology terms for the day. But the mycelium grows through the soil and also penetrates into the roots of the plant, of higher plants, of many kinds. In fact, most plants, higher plants, both conifers and flowering plants, have some kind of association with fungi in the soil, something like 60%. And there are certain families that it's an obligate relationship. It has to be there for the plants to grow. In other cases, it's a sort of an optional benefit. And there's a classic experiment in forest silviculture where they take a sterile medium and plant conifer seedlings in it, like pines or Douglas fir. And then they take another sterile medium, plant the seedlings in it, but they inoculate it with mycorrhizal fungi. And there's a very pronounced benefit of having the fungus in the soil, that those conifers grow much bigger than the ones that are growing in a sterile medium. And so the understanding is that the fungus acts as an extension of the root system. I have some photos of some very specialized plants that have this relationship with mycorrhizal fungi. And this includes the big conifers in the forest. It also includes a lot of herbaceous, the little plants that grow in the understory. So mycorrhizal fungi. A lot of people confuse the fungi and the bacteria because they're both invisible and they're both in the soil. And they're both mutually beneficial relationships. But the main thing to think of as a difference is that these are for the fixing of nitrogen, which only bacteria can do. And these, the fungi, are acting as an extension of the roots of the plant. Does this make sense so far?
Yeah.
Okay. The last one is probably not ecologically as important. These are really important ecological processes in the health of the forest. The fungi in the soil, the bacteria in the soil, are really important to the health. The last example is sort of a little quirk in nature in a way. I don't know that it really affects the forest as a whole, but they're interesting to us, and they show some more about the relationship with fungi. These are called saprophytes. And I'll show you some pictures of these. I'll put it in quotes because saprophytes, what that word means is living off dead material. And you know, fungi grow in the soil and they decompose wood, and so they live off dead organic material. That's where they derive their nutrient. They have what's called external digestion. The mycelium growing in the soil and growing in organic material releases acids and enzymes into the soil around it, and then absorbs the broken down nutrients through the into the fungus. So the actual digestion happens outside of the body of the fungus. When people first started studying these so-called saprophytes, they thought they did the same thing, because they don't have any photosynthesis, they're not green, they're flowering plants that seem to be growing out of dead material. But as we've studied them, or as they've been studied, we found out that it's a three-way symbiosis. And the symbiosis is between a flowering plant, a fungus, which is a type of mycorrhizal fungi, and a conifer. So I'll draw that diagrammatically. You have the soil, surface of the soil here, and you have this thing growing, this flowering plant growing. I'll just draw it diagrammatically over here. I'll try to squeeze it in. My drawing is not going to be very realistic. But it's diagrammatic. So here's the flowering plant, number one. And in the soil, it has this association with the fungi. And I'm going to draw it way over here so you can have room to draw it for you. And then this has a connection with a tree, which is photosynthetic. And this, in these cases, it's a conifer. Just for a digression, this is very diagrammatic, but can you guess what species of conifer that is?
Hemlock.
It's a hemlock, right? Very good. Hemlocks have a drooping terminal leaf. So even though this is not a very good drawing, that field characteristic will tell you that it's a hemlock. The tip grows, even if it's a little seedling a foot high, or if it's a 150-foot high tree. So what we have is the flowering plant and the fungus have a mutually beneficial relationship. At least we think it's a two-way process, that the fungus is getting some kind of material from the plant, and the plant is getting nutrient through the fungus. And then the tree is probably being parasitized by this relationship. So in this case, it's a parasitism of the tree by this saprophyte. Because the tree is producing sugars, which are the food, which feeds the whole system. The food is transported through the roots into the flowering plant. So an added complication, it's probable that the tree is getting some benefit from the fungus, because it is a mycorrhizal fungi. But it seems unlikely that the tree is getting any benefit from the flowering plant.
Is that the Linnea flower grow that way?
No, I don't think so. I think Linnea, because it's green, I think it's just a photosynthetic plant.
It was on that dead stuff, that's why.
It often is. I mean, it does often grow in decaying wood.
Yeah.
But I don't, it's not considered a saprophyte because it is green. If it did get some benefit from other plants, then it would be, in some ways, a parasite of those plants. But I don't know that it is. Well, let me show you some pictures. But before I do, let me add the third kind, because it'll come up in the pictures. The third kind of a symbiosis is parasitism, which is just what it sounds like. Where in this is another kind of symbiosis. In this, one of the species benefits and one is harmed. And I'll show you a couple of pictures of plants that are parasitic. Can you see that okay with the fence? Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. All right, so any questions before I take this down?
I have a quick question about that saprophyte. At home in Minnesota, sometimes you see a ring of mushrooms around a tree.
Yeah.
Is that a saprophyte relationship as well?
Probably what those mushrooms are is probably a mycorrhizal fungi.
Okay.
Because a saprophyte always is a flowering plant.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because I knew it wasn't a flowering plant.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, a lot of these mycorrhizal fungi, which most of the life cycle you don't see, it's in the soil, but they have fruiting bodies, they call them fruiting bodies, which are mushrooms. And so a lot of the common forest mushrooms that people pick and eat, or but they don't, are mycorrhizal fungi that are benefiting the trees. And we only happen to see them when conditions are just right for them to put up mushrooms.
Okay.
So most of their life cycle is underground. Any other questions? Great. Okay, well, let me just show you a few pictures. Some of these examples of symbiosis. Maybe you could help. Could you help me put that curtain as dark as we can get it, the better. Take me a second. I think I'll even run upstairs and close that one. So I think it'll. Since these things grow on the understory, they're hard to see.
Darker than it. Keeps the heat out. Huh? I just love the way this building is going on.
Yeah.
I love that little loft.
Now this, anybody know the name of this?
Indian
pipe.
Pipe, yeah.
That's right. One of its names is Indian pipe. It actually has two common names I know of. It's Indian pipe or ghost pipe. Just been out of focus. I'm going to have to try to find this projector doesn't have an autofocus, so it might have to keep focusing. But this is a saprophyte. It's pretty common in the Northwest. And I think it grows across the continent. Have you seen it in the East, anybody? I know. But it's a saprophyte. It's a flowering plant. These are flowers. It's in the family that includes huckleberries and blueberries. And heather, the heath family is called. And it's connected in the soil with a fungus, which is connected to conifers. So it's an example of a saprophyte, or so-called saprophyte. Very unusual plant. This is another kind of saprophyte. It's in some ways even more striking. It's got these red and white stripes.
Mm-hmm.
This one is starting to fade a little bit. It's called candy stripe. And it's also in that same family, the heath family. And it has no photosynthesis. There's no green leaves. And we think it's connected with a fungus in the soil, which is connected to trees. So another example of the saprophyte. There's two families that seem to have this capability. Two families in the Northwest, anyway. The heath family and the orchid family. And this is an orchid which grows in the Northwest. It grows here along Lake Chelan. It's called ghost orchid. And it's pure white. The flowers are white and the whole plant is white. And it has no photosynthesis. So it's another example of this saprophytic habit. The orchids produce very tiny seeds that don't have any nutritive tissue. And so the only way that these orchids, even the orchids that are green, have green leaves, the only way they can grow is if those seeds fall where they come in contact with a fungus, with the right fungus. And the fungus acts, that mycorrhizal fungi symbiosis, it happens before the seeds even can germinate. The fungus has to penetrate the seed and start to provide nutrition so the plant can grow. Of course, a green orchid with green leaves, we think would respond by returning sugar to that fungus. So it's a mutually beneficial. This is actually one species. Most often it looks like this. This is called spotted coral root. And it's common around here. It actually, if you get a chance up by the ballpark, in the woods around the ballpark, there's a lot of this orchid, spotted coral root. And it's usually reddish like that. Occasionally you get a yellow individual. So there's some kind of a genetic difference between these two. But it's still one species. And they still have this mycorrhizal association. They're parasitizing the trees around them through the medium of a fungus. And as I said, they're small plants and they probably don't have much of an effect on the plant they're parasitizing. It's kind of like a dog having fleas. You know, that doesn't it doesn't weaken the plant very much. There's a close-up of spotted coral root. A lot of these orchids in the Northwest, they're very tiny. There's even tinier ones that are, you know, less than a quarter of an inch across. So you really need to have some kind of magnification to see what they look like. This is a third type. This is another type. This is in the heath family. Sorry, guys. This is to keep people from falling asleep here in the cool dark. But it's in the heath family, and it's called pine sap. And very colorful little plants. You can see how big it is. There's a Douglas fir cone right next to it. And
did you take the pictures?
Yeah, I took all these pictures. And this is our biggest one. This is called pine drops, or Andromeda is the genus. But it grows abundantly around here, and I've seen it in the valley.
Is that what we used to call it, tobacco plant?
You might have. I haven't heard that name for it, but there's lots of local names, and I think they're all valid names. There's other plants that I remember being called tobacco plant, which were different. They were green plants that dried up, but I don't recommend you smoke this. But
maybe.
I don't know. Yeah, who knows what its effect would be. But this is real. I mean, this grows, you know, 5 feet tall sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's another saprophyte parasitizing trees through the fungus. So those are the examples of saprophytes, which I think are just interesting, you know, sort of oddities. And this is an actual parasite. This is called broom rape. And it grows by parasitizing other flowering plants. And most often, I don't know if you know what sedum is. It's called stonecrop. It's kind of a succulent flowering plant. It's common around here. And, you know, there's species just about anywhere there's very much sunlight. And so this broom rape is one species that actually parasitizes that. This is another photo of the same thing. This is just another example of a, it's kind of backtracking, but this is another saprophytic orchid. Let me see if I can focus that just a little bit. This is remember the spotted coral root? This is a striped coral root, just a different species, but with the same habit. This is an example. This is called pink pyrola, or pink wintergreen pyrola acerifolia, and it grows very abundantly on the trail that goes up the valley. If you go up here before, you either climb up to Heart Lake or continue on to Heart Lake or climb up to Holden. There's a lot of this growing along the trail. There might even be a little right behind the village. I think I've seen it right behind Hike House. It's not usually quite this pink, this pretty dark coloration. But this is an example of this. This does have green leaves. You can't see them because they're all down at the base, down in this other foliage. But it does require that fungus, the mycorrhizal fungi, in order to grow. And it's an example of a type of plant that's very hard to plant in your garden or dig up and move to your garden. Because if it loses that fungus association, then it's not able to grow. Might be the last example, but like a small probably. Oh. Yeah, I'd like to show you this too, but this is kind of just, I'll end with this oddity. I'll have to turn it upside down. Let's see if there's another photo. I guess that's the last one. This is upside down for one thing, but I can change that. This is called butterwort, and it's an insectivorous plant. And the way it connects in with our discussion is that, as I was saying, nitrogen is a often limiting nutrient. And these plants have developed a different way of getting nitrogen. They get it from insects. And so these leaves down here are kind of sticky. And the insects, if they happen to come and land on these leaves, which are also bright yellow, which tends to attract insects, they get stuck and are killed. Eventually, I don't know if they're killed by enzymes in the plant or they just end up dying there, being stuck. Then the plant digests the insects and is able to get its nitrogen through them, because insects have proteins, it's able to get its nitrogen through those insects. So it's kind of another, maybe not too ecologically important, but another kind of oddity. Unusual things in nature. So I think we're going to be running into lunch here in a second. Let me just, for review, just go back to this outline. Now that we've talked so much about different kinds of organisms and how they interact, just to remember that we're talking about bacteria, like the nitrogen-fixing bacteria in the alder roots, or legumes. Many ways where fungi interact with flowering plants, like through these saprophytes, or through mycorrhizal associations, like with the wintergreen, which is not a saprophyte, but still has to have this fungus. We also talked about how fungi interact with conifers as extensions of the root systems. And then the other type of symbiosis we talked about is essentially parasitism, which is there are flowering plants that parasitize others. So, my presentation on symbiosis, maybe the last stage of review to remember these basic or general types. Lichens, like these, different kinds of lichens. Nitrogen-fixing bacteria, with forming an association with legumes or with alders. Mycorrhizal fungi, involving most of the plants in nature. And then saprophytes is just kind of a flashy example of complex interactions. So any questions? Will this affect how you look at nature when you go out and walk in the woods?
Absolutely.
Good. Great.
Great.
One quick question. Back in the Midwest, we have a thing we call Jack in the Pulpit.
Yeah.
Is that one of these?
Is
that really a flowering?
It's definitely a flowering plant.
I couldn't remember because I remembered it had the leaves coming up, but you know, like some of these look quite similar. I was just trying to.
Right. What Jack of the Pulpit is an example where the flowers are on this stalk in the middle. Mm-hmm. It's called a spadix. It has a bunch of little tiny flowers. And then the leaf, which comes over the top, that serves to be the attractant for pollinators.
Okay.
So the flower itself is not very showy, but the leaves become showy, which are a lot of other things that do that too.
Okay.
We have him out here too. We have Jack of the Pulpit out here.
You know, I don't know if I've ever seen it in Washington. Have you seen it in the Northwest?
Maybe I've.
There's skunk cabbage, which is a lot.
Skunk cabbage, yeah.
Which is similar, and it's the leaf, the showy leaf that acts as. It's the same family, skunk cabbage.
I've seen it because I lived in Wisconsin, so that's probably.
Oh, yeah. I used to live in New Hampshire and Maine, and we used to have Jack of the Pulpit. Any other questions? Any questions on topics of plants that I could help you with? How many people are from Washington? So a couple of you. And the rest of you from?
Minnesota.
I have been fortunate the last couple of years to have some projects in Minnesota. So I've been going out there, not very often, but once a year.
Where do you go?
Well, one of our projects was looking at the effects of proposed burning in the Boundary Waters wilderness.
Oh, that's
after the blowdown.
Yeah, it's a real controversy.
Yeah, it's controversial, and so our company was hired just to go in and determine what the effects of doing that would be.
Aren't they re-evaluating that whole issue of burning and because hasn't the philosophy of the government been to protect, and that's caused an overgrowth?
Right.
And as a result, it's just there's so much you can't control a burn if it burns.
That's the general story throughout, especially in the West, but also in the Midwest, in Minnesota, that in most places, fire was a natural occurring process that happened periodically, either frequently or infrequently. And because we've been so effective at stopping fires, that we've had a buildup of fuel.
Is there any more discussion of trying to harvest some of that wood?
Well, they can't. There's two problems in the Boundary Waters, in the wilderness. There's two problems. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for
having your child here too. There's two main problems with taking any timber out of there. First, it's against the law. When the wildernesses were established, a specific part of the law is it's illegal to harvest timber out of them. The second problem is the feasibility of taking anything out of there is not economically feasible. If they were going to harvest with helicopters, for example, salvage, the limit of the helicopter harvest is about a mile. Anything beyond that is just too expensive and too slow. So you have the whole Boundary Waters wilderness, and even if you could harvest that out a mile, you couldn't really go in and take much out. So that's the problem within the Boundary Waters. It's not feasible and it's not legal, so you'd have to, it'd require an act of Congress to change the law. And so they're bound to not be able to do that.
And I know they're really concerned about it. If that thing lights up, then it's going to be really a massive fire.
Yeah, it could be a real problem. That's why they developed a strategy for this 5-year plan of doing controlled burns, specifically to protect the settlements that are outside the wilderness. And so they've, you know, mapped where all the lakes are and where the blowdown is the worst, and then come up with different treatments. There's some areas they were going to do broadcast burning, and other areas they're going to do clearings, you know, smaller areas.
If they would do selective burning, those could get away from them as well.
Well, that's always a danger. Yeah, that's a danger. That one of their strategies for that is to do those late in the year, so that just before the weather starts getting bad, so they know they're going to go out. You get a fire going in the summer, and it can go all summer. Yeah, so there, that's those are some of the problems with doing anything. I think in Canada they were much more, they weren't so constrained in what they were able to do legally, so they were more able to go in and rapidly and harvest. That blowdown was interesting because most of it was in the U.S. In fact, if we looked at lots of maps that were mapping out where the blowdowns were, and a lot of it stopped right at the border. You know, you'd almost think it was some kind of international conspiracy. But
trees are stronger in Canada.
Maybe that's it. Yeah.
Hey.
Any other questions I can answer for you? So next week, our folks are going to be here next week?
No.
Oh, you're leaving?
Meeting on Monday.
Oh, leaving on Monday. Well, there's another bot that's coming in today. Are you leaving today? Oh, yeah. That's all I am. There's another bot that's coming in today, Ellen Coolman, a friend of mine, so she can give you another perspective on this.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. It was really good.
Thank you for coming. I hope it wasn't too much of a biology class.
Are you a teacher, or what do you do?
Well, I work for a consulting firm.
Oh, okay.
Primarily. I just do a little teaching if I can. Thank you for coming.
Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right, where are you headed?
I'm reading. 88.
Sure.
Well, that's not young, but...
It's not real old either.
But you have to choose your... I used to go hiking in this place in New Hampshire, in the mountains. You know, I do love to hike, but there was this grove of trees right at the trailhead. And I always thought, well, when I get to where I can't walk, I'll just take a chair and go sit in that grove of trees. Was, you know, like 100 yards, and you wouldn't be able to see a soul. And it was a birch grove, a beech grove. I always liked those beech trees. Like, I'll bring a thermos of tea and let the other people go hiking. I'll wait for them, and I'll just sit and enjoy the place.
Well, I hiked as far as the footbridge across there, and saw the Sound.
Oh, yeah.
I took a picture of an old hill. Ran out of film, I didn't have any with me.
Oh, yeah.
There's a nice bench just on the road just past that bridge, but you sit down and none of the mosquitoes there, please.
That's the problem, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful view of the river.
And later on, it'll be the flies.
Yeah, yes.
There's a few around now, yeah.
No, not as bad as they sometimes are.
Yeah,
I think it's cold out here. I'm not going to throw on my jacket.